Hey, hey, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, 2013, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
What is this? Are you trying to trick me? Where's the sports?
Did someone promise you sports? Yikes. Look out, y'all. Because my friend and fellow therapist and all-round amazing person, Brittany Steffen, is back with us again today for part two of her appearance on this, the Sex Wisdom Show. She made quite a stir last week with her premiere performance, so I can hardly wait to chat with her again this week.
Is this a kissing book?
I like Brittany a lot, but I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of kissing. But you just never know. But wait, did you miss part one of our conversation? Not to worry if you did, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you have to do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 384, and presto! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search. Brittany invites you to visit her on her site, seattlecounselor.org. And of course, she's on Facebook and Twitter too. And for your convenience, all these links are in today's podcast posting on my site, drdicksexadvice.com.
When's it get good?
Keep your shirt on because we have an announcement to make first. Today's program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. You know, even though I get tons of email from folks looking for my advice, I can only respond to a limited number of inquiries at any given time. But that doesn't mean that I don't care about everyone who writes in. I do. That's why I've set up my How-To Video Library. You'll find a link to this great resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Video Library tab in the header. The Video Library is the go-to place for all of you who have sexual performance questions. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, delightfully enriching, and oh-so-informative videos right from the comfort of your own home.
I don't believe this.
I could see where it would be a little confounding. And remember, a portion of the money that you spend at Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library, educating, enriching, and entertaining yourself, come back to us as support for these marvelous shows. So knock yourself out. Okay, on with the show. Brittany, welcome back, and thank you again for stopping by drdicksexadvice.com for this part two of your turn on the Sex Wisdom podcast. So glad to have you back. We were just getting to the nub of you last week when time ran out, and we were talking about sex and religion and all my favorite topics, and I'd like to move on from there if that's good for you.
Yeah, we've figured it all out.
Exactly. So, all right. So let's talk about sex positions. Whole books have been written about the best sex positions for different types of bodies, and I even do a workshop on the topic. And I suppose that if all of this sex position stuff was so important, God would have given us a vivid imagination and flexible joints. Oh, wait, she did.
True story. I totally agree with you again.
Yay, of course you do, because otherwise I'd turn the microphone right off, don't you know?
I bet. I would not put it past you.
So do you have anything that you want to throw out there about sex positions, why people are so fixated on them?
Yeah, I do. I think that people talk a lot about sex positions because there's a market for it.
Yes,
and I think
absolutely.
That there's a market for it because of the two different but equally important and revealing reasons. And I think the first reason is that people are trying to spice things up in their relationship. And I think that says something about how we really feel about monogamy and how it can get boring. And keeping it from getting boring requires a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of really attending to it before, you know, before it's too late. And that's where the new and exciting position idea comes from, at least from that point of view.
Well, it's a lot less threatening than, you know, going out and finding another partner or changing the whole way that you interact with
yeah.
your partner or, you know, whatever it might be.
It's a lot cheaper and less
it's
than,
true.
Like, a new
true.
Toy or whatever, right?
Yeah. And at the same time, there are therapeutic reasons why somebody would be in one position as opposed to another. I mean, there's lots to be said about that. I know a lot of people poo-poo the whole thing, and there are people who, you know, want to hang from the chandeliers or they're not happy, and the other ones that, you know, can't get any more edgy than the missionary position. So, I mean, there's a vast array of how people respond.
Yeah, and that I think goes right back to how people view what their sex life should be like. I think there's a lot of shoulding around.
Yeah. Well, women's magazines are really responsible for that. Not so much men magazines, but women for sure.
I think that leads me right into the second reason I think people are mainly focused on sexual positions, which is body image and really cultural views around beauty, and, you know, where's the position where you look the best in? Where's the best?
It's true.
that leads us to a whole other conversation about, you know, performance anxiety, and again, all of the shoulding.
Right. Yeah. It's tragic, it seems to me, what we do to ourselves. Instead of just enjoying, you know, and that's, interestingly enough, a big part of my sex therapy outreach is just getting people to be in the moment. You know, your sensations are flooding your body, but you are, you know, worrying about your hair or how, you know, you look, or, you know, are your boobs perky and, you know, is my dick big enough and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And it's short-circuiting all that wonderful, wonderful sensation that could give you the sexual high that, you know, most people are after to begin with.
Yeah, there's so much pressure and so much expectations around living up to the lives of everyone else that we see broadcasted on the internet and stuff. I feel like I sound like I'm like 80 years old right now, but
you're not? Oh, wait.
No. I'm only 25. I'm like a spring friend. But I don't know. I think like we have a lot of pressure to do everything to the max, and then it
young
creates
people
anxiety.
Have that.
And
older people have, you know, the pressure to conform. And it inevitably gets in the way for each group, it seems to me.
Yeah, it really does. It's, again, that going back to that really creating your own reality and creating problems.
Well, the other end of the spectrum from sexual exclusivity and monogamy is swinging and polyamory. Can we talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I can. I totally feel absolutely confident being able to define.
Oh, good. What are the similarities and differences?
Okay, so swinging and polyamory fall under an umbrella, right, of open relationships, which we can also define as sort of an alternative to traditional monogamy, as an open relationship. They involve some sort of sexual or emotional contact outside of said relationship, but the whole open piece is so different than monogamy and cheating and affairs, because the open piece replies that everyone's on board, you're on the same page, but then again, because there are still some sort of rules and regulations around how open you are, you can still have sort of cheating in the traditional monogamous sense if someone like breaks those rules. So I think that that's a really cool similarity. And then under, again, that umbrella are swinging and polyamory. And a lot of people think that those are not very different things, but I think they're totally different. Swinging is like, what, couple-centric, right? It involves a couple having sex with other people or other couples. And that sexual contact can range from being totally anonymous to being friends with benefits. But it's still emotionally monogamous versus polyamory, right? Which is the complete opposite of swinging, which is that you're part of a couple and you are having sex with other people, but the sex is just one part of an emotional connection and an emotional relationship.
Right.
So they're really different, right?
I think so, too. And, you know, and a lot of the people that practice, you know, either one or the other of these, you know, oftentimes can actually swing back and forth, no pun intended, but, you know, in some situations it's much more of a swinging kind of thing, or they came from a swinging background and they find themselves now in more of a polyamorous mindset where, you know, it's not all about physicality and it's much more about emotional kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I think that you definitely have to approach swinging versus polyamory with totally different mindsets.
Right.
And have totally different conversations with your primary partner about what those relationships and what that context is going to look like.
The thing that you said a little while ago, too, about the rules and regulations, I mean, for open relationships to work just like exclusive relationships to work, there are ground rules. And it's dependent that, as you said, that both parties, or all people concerned, are on the same page. Everybody knows what is expected, you know, what the rules are, and no one violate them. And that's the problem that I think a lot of monogamous people think about these open relationships, is that it's devil may care and whatever comes, you know, down the pike, and, you know, there are no ground rules and, you know, it's a free-for-all. But that's not true.
No, I think that that's the funniest misconception ever. Yeah. Because no matter what, if you're in a relationship, your partner does things that say to you, you are important, I have chosen you, this is my most important relationship. And those things have to go on for a relationship to work, because you have to deal with the daily grind of them, like, annoying you and, like, leaving, you know, candy wrappers on the counter, not speaking from experience.
That just came right into your head, huh?
So those agreed-upon rules say, you're important and I love you, even if you're sleeping with other people.
Right. That's true.
And that's why being poly is so much more work than it can be a lot more work, because you do have to make the time to have those kind of conversations. And I think you have to do a lot of communicating. And then, you know, you follow the rules and you deal with relationship issues like conflict and different sexual preferences. And then you kind of hope for the best, just like a monogamous couple.
Well, you know, the thing is that I think monogamy is equally demanding of, you know, our time and our effort. But very few people actually put that kind of time and effort into it, because it's, you know, it's inertia, it's, you know, the path of the least resistance, and we've always done it this way, and we don't have to talk about it. But, you know, I see this in my practice, and I suppose you see it in yours as well, when monogamous couples, sexually exclusive couples come to us, they haven't checked in with one another for a very long time, and, you know, they're, you know, relative strangers, intimate strangers, interestingly enough, to one another, that we've always done it this way, and so, you know, we're going to continue to do it such, and, you know, it's the source of so much problem. And I think that, you know, monogamous couples could learn a great deal from those people who are experiencing different relationship models.
Yeah, I think that you bring up a really good point, which is the value of having a check-in.
Yeah.
And poly couples, like you're saying, and swinging couples, it's totally natural to be like, okay, are you happy with this? Are we comfortable? You have that what we're calling a check-in, which is really a conversation about, are your needs getting met in the relationship? Are you happy? Do you have any complaints that you can bring up and address now instead of stewing on them for the next 20 or 30 years?
Right. And, you know, how do we fine-tune, you know, the relationship rules? You know, our relationship rules at one time were, you know, when we swing, it's going to be a soft swing as opposed to a hard swing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, our polyamorous rules are going to be that we can go do this, but, you know, this other stuff is verboten. And then, you know, you check in and say, well, you know, I think we can actually adjust those, and, you know, so that we can even, you know, become more happy and fulfilled.
Yeah, I think that's like a key to, that's the key to a healthy long-term relationship, is being flexible and being able to change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Because people change over time.
It's true.
Yeah, my parents, or my dad, always says, like, you know, as he's kind of looking ahead to me someday getting married and producing grandchildren for them all to play with, That
because that's all you're good for.
I mean, yeah, apparently.
When you stop
right?
to think about it.
Entertainment. There's something to the idea that marriage is, you know, not until death do us part, but until you change into someone that I don't like,
right.
basically. And that's a reason behind why a lot of people get divorced, is
yeah.
because people do change over time. But I think if you can check in and chat about it periodically,
yeah.
maybe once a week or once a month, I would recommend,
mm-hmm.
You can have some really good conversations. Although you can also have some really hard conversations, too.
Yeah, but those are important ones. I mean,
yeah.
the hard ones are just as important as, you know, what are we having for dinner?
Yeah,
you know, kind of thing. So.
I would always tell my friends that they should check in with their significant others. So, like, if they're complaining to me about a boyfriend, I'm like, oh, you should do a check-in. And then sometimes it comes back to bite me in the butt because it doesn't go, like, the way they want it to.
Yeah. But we don't have, we don't really, you know, have any skills along those lines. I mean, nobody has really told us, you know, particularly when we were younger, that, you know, this is how you go about it. And when you open yourself up to a discussion about this, you can't have it always your way. You're going to have to listen to the other person. You're going to have, you know, a sense of sympathy and with the other person's perspective, you know, try to understand it in the same way that you're hoping that they are going to try to be sympathetic and understanding of yours.
Yeah.
But we don't practice that. I mean, when was the last time, you know, you saw something in the popular culture that, you know...
That addressed that?
Exactly.
Almost never. I mean, I can tell you all about the farming practices of Egyptian society.
True, isn't it?
Sixth grade, but
yeah.
they never talked
right.
to us about
right.
about the more important and useful things like
right.
how to deal with the fear and anxiety that comes with being in a really intimate relationship.
Right. Let's move on to some other cultural trends. One is one big one for me is the circumcision debate. Would you like to weigh in on this?
Yeah,
I oh, yay. Good things.
So when I wrote a paper on this in college that I remember vaguely well, and my attitude on circumcision is that it is an old religious and now cultural tradition that's
yeah.
pretty much good for nothing.
Yes.
You know, if you aren't circumcised, you know, wash things, practice safe sex. And if you really feel the need to fit in with the masses of people that are circumcised, you can do it later.
Yep.
But I think that performing circumcision on someone that's an infant, I mean, I don't want to be dramatic, but I would compare it to female genital mutilation. Like,
yes.
that's what I did in my little paper in college.
Yes.
I don't think
that's being dramatic. I think, you know,
okay.
we ought to speak the truth, to tell you the truth.
I think that it can come off as dramatic because circumcision is so widely accepted that people don't even think about it.
Yeah. But we ought to, because we're doing something radical
and permanent
to the genitals of infants, and you know I think that's unconscionable. I mean, I am a firm believer in the right of an adult to augment, adorn, embellish, or in any other way customize his or her body. At the same time, I'm a furious proponent of genital integrity. I mean, that just, you know, it means so much. And, you know, so many of the problems that I see in my practice, particularly with men, is, you know, related to circumcision.
Yeah, really?
Yes.
Huh.
I mean, you know, 50% of the skin of your dick is taken away, and it's never going to grow back, you know.
Well, when you put it like that, yeah.
It's true. It's true. And if you propose it to a man and you say, okay, I'm going to lop off 50% of your skin on your dick, and is that okay with you? Most people say no.
I think that, like, don't you think that the debate, though, is such a debate because there are so many people that are already circumcised and they don't want to hear that this was terrible
yes,
and shouldn't have
true.
Happened. It can't
it's
grow
true.
Back.
And,
I mean, there's nothing
and,
to be done.
And just as you say, I mean, it has... very strong religious overtones
mm-hmm.
to it. And, I mean, they're culturally induced, you know, for centuries and centuries, and, you know, it is the way it is. And but not to address something, or not even to raise the question, and, you know, I get into trouble all the time when, you know, I'm chatting with pregnant women about this very issue, because you know they just you know their father did it and their grandfather did it and you know their son is going to do it too. So, but if you ask them and you say, you know, do you know what actually is happening here? I think they have second thoughts. They may go ahead and circumcise anyhow, but at least I made them think.
Yeah, I think that that's a good thing. Thinking is awesome.
Yeah, it is.
And, questioning meaningless, possibly harmful traditions is really important.
Right. Particularly where there's knives involved.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, I know people, you know, this was the funniest thing, because years and years ago, I was having this conversation about circumcision, and it was not in the popular culture as much as it is now, and I was talking to somebody who had recently had a daughter, and her her mother wanted her daughter to pierce the ears of her infant daughter's or granddaughter's
ears.
Yes, exactly. So, and the mother was horrified. You know, oh my goodness, you know, let her choose that when she's. But it was an old family tradition that little girls, you know, infants would have their ears pierced, and and she was up in arms about the ear piercing, but not so much circumcision. Was
hello.
Weird. I know. It's like cuckoo.
Which is more permanent?
There you go. Another interesting topic in the popular culture these days is same-sex marriage.
Oh,
why are we so polarized, do you suppose?
Well, I think that just because I'm the daughter of both gay parents and straight married parents, I look at this from the side of the debate of marriage, family, children, religion.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people obviously believe that marriage is a religious tradition between a man and a woman, and perhaps it used to be, but now it's a cultural institution, right? And that's my answer to the marriage between a man and a woman thing. But then you can also look at it from the more successful argument, which has been for the conservative side of people to argue that it's not good for the children. And so I've spent some time in my practice as a therapist and in my own research really looking at LGBTQ parenting statistics and findings on what outcomes are out there for the kids of LGBTQ parents. Are there any negative effects? I did a couple presentations I did a presentation for LGBTQ high school students about this very topic. So I combed through all the research and found that there are essentially zero negative effects from having gay parents. You may get bullied a little bit more, but that's, again, not an effect of having gay parents. That's an effect of having gay parents in a world that doesn't fully accept your family. People with gay parents are also more likely to be more open-minded, hey, and more accepting.
And look at how you turned out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, totally.
Should be the poster girl.
Look at me. I think that it's threatening, right? It's got to be threatening to people that are in traditional marriages.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be such a popular debate.
But I think you make a really good point about the difference between a civil, legal kind of connection and that happens in a civil marriage, as opposed to like a sacramental kind of thing in a church situation. And I think we are able to redefine both things accordingly. It seems to me that we can make any church that doesn't want to have same-sex marriage, fine and dandy, knock yourself out.
Yeah,
don't.
I don't. When my dad and his partner get married, they're not going to get married in a church, but they're going to get legally married, and it's going to take, for me, it's going to be extremely important that they're able to do that, because, I remember growing up with them, and, you have your dad's part, my dad's partner had trouble picking me up from places.
True.
There's no paperwork for him. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
When my dad's partner actually had like a benign brain tumor a long time ago, and I remember my dad being really worried about being able to see him in the hospital.
Yes.
Really basic things like that have nothing to do with religion and everything to do the practical stuff of life.
Exactly that. Exactly that.
So I'm excited. I'm really happy that I was passed in Washington.
Me too. And, you know, that now that Doma's dead, you know,
Sorry
for that. Let's move on to teenage sexuality. Sex education, whose role is it? Parents, school, both?
So I guess I have some strong opinions about this.
You don't say.
I remember growing up with, obviously I grew up with some, with like four parents. Two of them were conservative, two of them were liberal. And my more conservative parents really were into education around puberty and around abstinence-only education. And it was similar in my school growing up, which is that we were taught pretty much abstinence-only sex education in high school. So ideally, I think that school is for teaching facts about biology and about disease and about pregnancy and you know, factual stuff that everyone needs to know. I think that it should start at a very early age and continue every year with more age-appropriate information as the children march on towards adulthood, right? And then you can have the parents right there, too, teaching the values side of things. So the parents can come in and talk about our family and our values and our attitudes towards sex and sexuality. And that way, even if you have parents that are too freaked out to talk about sex, you're still going to learn how to not have a million babies and get tons of STIs before you graduate and go off to college. And then when you're old enough, you can go back and yell at your parents for not teaching you more, but at least you won't have, you know, syphilis and eight children.
Right. So again, like we were talking about earlier, about how the difference between morality and facts.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I suppose one could have a morality about mathematics, but the facts, you know, math facts are math facts.
Yeah.
And so I mean, it's so curious to me, and we all get muddled up and say, well, you can't teach my kid that information because it's contrary to our morality. Well, it's information, and you can, you know, counter that information with your morality, but you know, the information is factual based, and you can't have your own facts.
I love that you say that, because that's exactly what drives me bonkers about this debate. You can't argue the fact that this is how people get pregnant, and this is something that you can avoid by doing X, Y, and Z, and that different, you know, different ways of avoiding pregnancy have different maybe value meanings for every family.
Right. And at the same time, I mean, like I don't know about you, but you know, as Dr. Dick, I get questions regularly. Things like, you know, if I have anal sex with my girlfriend, is she going to get pregnant? I mean, you know, connect the dots. I mean, if you are so estranged from your body and how it works that you can't answer that fundamental question for yourself, then we have done you a terrible disservice in our educating you.
Yeah. It's absurd. It's ridiculous, right? It's called education because it's about education, right? And I mean, I went to a really conservative, I'm from a conservative town, so I went to a high school that was governed by a conservative school board, right?
Yes.
And so they kind of, the school board sort of chooses what comes with your education. So I really received abstinence-only education. And I remember my teacher being like, sorry, I can't answer that. Sorry, I can't answer that. And we were all just like, what the hell? Like,
right.
We have questions. We want answers.
And they wouldn't do it in, you know, any other field of interest, it seems to me. I mean, I can't answer that, you know, calculus question because, or I can't answer that history question or, you know, that sociological question. You know, I mean, it's crazy. You know, I mean, we do each other such a terrible disservice. And I'm thinking that, you know, and then all that terrible information that we get because we're watching porn because we have no other reason or no other vehicle for getting the education, and it goes on and on. So we have very little time left, and which breaks my heart because I could go on and on about this. So let me ask you two final questions. Who inspires you, and who are your sexual heroes, if you have any?
Well, let's see. I'm really inspired as someone who's kind of fresh out of grad school, I'm really inspired by my professors from school that are, you know, rooted in the world of academia and interested in learning and never stopping learning. Especially if you're in a helping profession like me, you know, you can always do better with your clients. You can always have more information to offer them and more resources to offer them. So I'm inspired by people that don't get sick and tired of reading articles about therapy and reading books about therapy and are just ceaselessly dedicated to helping undo some of the stuff that we've talked about today out of our culture. And did you ask me who my sexual hero was?
If you have any, sure.
I think Dan Savage is one of my sexual heroes.
You are of that generation, are you not?
I grew up listening to the Savage Love cast, and I totally just would kill to I wouldn't kill to have his career. I would do a lot of things to have his career. And I think that, like, what he's doing, you know, he has the Savage Youth thing kind of going on right now.
Yes.
Just providing free advice and free education from someone that's done the research and done the work.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that he does too is does a really good job trying to make sure that he is giving everyone not just information, but really a range of options.
Right. And permission.
And permission, yeah.
Which is such a big part of it all. When it all boils down to, I mean, if I had only one thing that I could offer any of my clients at any one given time, it would be permission. Just go and try it. Just and suspend your judgment until you have some more data to make an enlightened decision. That's all you have to do. And if you need permission, I'm going to give it to you. So there.
I feel like half of the podcast today has been just me kind of agreeing with
it's
you.
It's so true. Well, you know, we're of the like mind, it seems to me. I mean, and we've been schooled in, you know, the facts. And, you know, we have strong opinions because of the facts that we have consumed, and not because, you know, our opinions are not based on, you know, this is what serves me best. It serves the facts.
Yeah, I think that's, again, another one of your fabulous points, is that, like, I don't want to ever have a conversation unless I have, you know, if unless I've done the legwork.
Right.
And if I haven't, then, you know, I'll tell you that and tell you that it's just my opinion. But I think that what we've been talking about is more than is opinion. It's our experience with people and our experience with working with couples and individuals, seeing firsthand what can go wrong and what helps make it right.
And the work that we've done on ourselves.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I totally applaud you. I think where you've come from, it has ruined lots and lots of other people. How you rose above it and become the remarkable person that you are is, if I was a religious man, I would say, you know, it was God's gift. But our time is up again. I'm sorry to let you go because this could go on and on for a long, long time. I'd like listening to you talk about your stuff. But before you go, would you give us your website address again? Walk us around. Tell us what we can find there. And you have a blog too, yes?
I do, yeah. You can find everything about my private practice or our private practice, and you can find my blog at seattlecounselor.org. I regularly blog. There are lots of really fun articles on our website, lots of cool links about mental health. And you can also find me on Facebook at Brittany A. Steffen and on Twitter at BrittSteff. Two T's, by the way.
Because you can't have too many of either.
Yeah.
Darlin, it was grand spending so much time in your company. We are
great
richer for the experience. I wish you all the best in your practice. I know that you're just getting started, and by the time you are my seriously advanced age, I know that the world will be a much better place because of your participation in it.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you so much for having me.
Okay, kiddo. Be well, be happy, and we'll have lunch again soon.
That would be great.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
What a delightful show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next week at this time for another Sex Wisdom Show, when my guest will be cultural anthropologist and sex researcher Dr. Catherine Frank. And more sex advice with an edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library.
You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
What word would that be? Dick? Video? Library? I don't know. Listen up, buckaroos. Thanks to this amazing technology, you'll be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your own home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like nobody's business. Check it out. You'll find a link to this fabulous sex resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the tab that reads Video on Demand. There is no membership fee. This is a pay-per-minute sort of deal. So your pay-per-view minutes allow you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Pretty gall darn sweet, huh? And remember, a portion of the money that you spend at Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library, educating, enriching, and entertaining yourself, comes back to us as support for these marvelous shows. So knock yourself out. Okay, until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.